All right. Welcome to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com, the show exploring the link between economic exploitation and social injustice. I'm Louis Moroni, and I'm with me as always is Jim.
Hello.
And today we have been welcomed in and given the opportunity to record our show in the store Smash in the Junction region of Toronto. Smash is a Toronto-based business founded in 2008. It operates from a 4,300 square foot showroom in the city's West End. Owner Paul Mercer is an art history graduate with a long background in antiques, art, and salvage. And the business is a well-regarded and inspiring source of high-quality vintage materials, furnishings, and fixtures. You'll see some photos or a photo on our website, afterthecollapse.net. Alder has been a fantastic host. Thank you very much. And Carmen Victor is our guest today, and we are talking about austerity in the arts, which means that we're in a fitting location. And Carmen has an MFA from the University of Victoria and an MA in art history from York University. She has served in various curatorial capacities at institutional, non-institutional galleries and organizations over the past 15 years, and in the past few months, she has recently presented conference papers on her research at Queen's University, OCAD-U, and in the joint graduate program in communication and culture at York University. She's currently serving on the board of directors at YYZ Artist Outlet, one of Toronto's established artist-run centers. Welcome, Carmen.
Thanks, you guys.
Okay, Jim.
So, Carmen, maybe we could just start by you generally laying a picture for us of the austerity and culture picture under Harper.
Right. So, recently, the feds axed $7.1 million from the Department of Foreign Affairs, $4.8 million from the trade routes, which I can explain what that is, and in 2012, they cut $5 million from the Canadian Studies Program, which is promoting Canada and promoting academics to travel to study Canada and funded academic travel. The trade routes is because I can't assume that everybody knows what it is, but basically galleries could access this government program that could ship art across Canada and internationally at below corporate rates. So it was government funded, so they could ship art, which is very expensive to ship art in general, but the feds axed that program, so that means that galleries have to spend top dollar to ship their work, which basically means less shows, less shipping, less transit.
Can you put it in context in terms of they've cut $5.1 million, mm-hmm. but from what pool of money? Mm-hmm.
Well, whichever funding they allocated to, they cut it. $5 million is a drop in the bucket for the government. It's a right. symbolic cut. It doesn't actually save them $5 million. They just allocated somewhere else. But they took it away from this thing that was not losing money, that served a good purpose for, especially in Canada, that's a huge country where transit is so important. They just cut that on a symbolic level. They've also cut the Canada Council, I believe, by $4 million this year. And there's talk of selling Canada House on Trafalgar Square in London, just selling it off to the highest bidder. Which I should add is it hasn't happened yet, but the value of that real estate exceeds whatever the government could get for it. So all of these, so from the feds on down, this sort of austerity measure kind of filters from provincial and municipal levels as well.
This has been a long-term program of Harper, obviously. I can recall way back to when the Reform Party existed and they ran in a campaign of ending funding for Bubbles Galore, the film that was sort of an erotic film that aired on Bravo, and that was in the campaign platform. What is it in particular about culture as opposed to other seemingly insignificant or frivolous aspects of the budget that makes it a directed target for austerity?
Right. Well, I mean, obviously the Harpers are, proponents of the neoliberal paradigm, which involves, unregulated free market enterprise, cutting expenditure cuts to social services, deregulation, privatization, and eliminating the idea of the public good or community. So those are Harper would support all of those things. So cuts to the arts, I mean, the neoliberal line is, if this art was worthy enough, it would survive on its own. But then you transpose that over to, like, the banks after the 2008 financial meltdown, it doesn't fly, because if those banks had been allowed to float on their own after the meltdown, they should be surviving without government bailouts. And same with the car companies. So it's a really, it's ideologically based. There's this notion of sort of national pride, identity through culture, that isn't espoused anymore. People don't really feel that the need to espouse Canadian culture throughout the world, and the government certainly doesn't feel that either, which is rather tragic, because one of the only ways to distinguish yourself as a country in a globe where, you know, economy and politics are very integrated, culture is like one way to distinguish yourself. And so, you know, the government obviously doesn't feel that way, but Quebec does, and Quebec preserves their funding for the arts in a very anti-austerity way.
So how has the government in initiating these cuts in advance consulted with the arts community?
They haven't. It's very, very limited. So let me give you just an example. When the Harper government first arrived in Parliament, typically the National Gallery of Canada outfits Parliament with works of art from their collection, so that the politicians, when they're doing their thing, and everybody who hangs out at Parliament Hill walks by certain works of art that are on the wall. So when the Harper government arrived and took power, I think it was 2006, they rescinded all the work. So they send it all back to the National Gallery, which is fine, because that would be normal. You don't want the same art that the previous government wants. No problem. But they never requested anything else to be replaced by it. So it's just, it is very weird, because there are a lot of high-level conservatives that do value the arts, that do want to outfit their offices. So I'm not trying to seem as though I'm monolithically condemning these people, but it was a symbolic move.
So, but how does that compare to past governments in terms of cuts? Because there have been cuts in the past. Mm-hmm. Has this been ill-proportionate?
Yeah.
With this government?
Ever since 1952, since the Massey Report came out. Sorry, that was 1949. So the Massey Report came out in 1949. 7 years later, the Canada Council, you know, became. And same with the NFB, same with the CBC, though I'm not sure on the dates. But they all arose out of the Massey Report, which was this grand plan that took 2 years across the country to figure out from Canadians how they wanted to have their culture, all of it, not just visual arts, but all of their culture sort of promoted and developed within the country. And from that Massey Report emerged the Canada Council for the Arts and the NFB and the CBC. And those should be very treasured national institutions, but now in the neoliberal paradigm, they're basically seen as frills, and they're fighting for survival in every sense. And how does it compare? Well, I mean, basically, it's been more than any other government has cut to the arts.
And how's Quebec fought?
Quebec is different. Okay. Quebec has a model that we should definitely emulate in the rest of Canada. Quebec understands this notion of preserving your culture through preserving your cultural output. So to distinguish themselves from the rest of Canada and for the rest of the world, and as a nation one and unto its own, they fund their artists. They realize it's a way, musicians, artists, poets, every kind of facet of cultural life, they promote, and they do promote it financially. They do fund their artists, and they do keep hanging on to programs and stuff, because they realize that they need to, that is their expression of identity, and they need to keep that if they want to have an identity.
Okay, so Jim, before we leave, are you good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're gonna take a quick break. We're here talking with Carmen Victor. We're talking about austerity in the arts, and you have some song selections. What one would you feel like hearing now?
It's actually called Starfucker by Julius.
All right. I looked that up. I thought it actually said Julius by Starfucker. Do those look like the right lyrics?
I think so,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's... Okay, so... Okay, tomato, tomato. So Julius by Starfucker.
Yeah.
Starfucker by Julius.
Starfucker by Julius.
And why? You just like the song?
I like the song, and the video is awesome. Great. You have to see it. It's so funny.
Cool. Okay. Go ahead, Julius.
Okay, I thought, yeah, the band was called Julius. Their song is called Starfucker.
Okay, well, that's good. Go ahead, Jim. Just start.
Welcome back to After the Collapse. I'm RadioRegion.com. I'm Jim Vernon here with Louis Maroney talking to Carmen Victor about austerity in the arts. We're here at Smash on Dundas West. And that was, well, that was a song. So the...
Well, it was Starfucker by Julius.
Should we take that again?
No, right?
That's good. Just let's keep on going.
Okay, so before we left, we were talking about the rather severe increase of cuts under Harper as opposed to previous regimes and the increasing nature of it. Maybe you can provide us with some examples of the kind of impact these cuts have on culture.
Okay, so everybody probably who is in the art world and the small publishing would probably know about Fuse magazine. But so Fuse, they changed the guidelines. Heritage Canada changed the guidelines on their granting model in that you had to have a minimum of 500 subscribers to your magazine and publish four times a year. And previously it had been 250. Now Fuse is a small run magazine. But they didn't have 500 subscribers, so it was very difficult to increase your readership like 100%. So with those changes to Heritage Canada, and then also the Ontario Arts Council reduced their funding, snowballed together, sort of signaled the impending finality of Fuse. And instead of sort of when these things, when these crises happen within arts organizations, what basically usually happens is the entire board quits and then new people come in and they deal with the hot potato. And that's typical, and that's happened over and over again at various organizations. So, but Fuse decided to put a stop to that, and they realized they were dealing with an unsustainable model, so they decided to shut down. And that's why, you know, many organizations don't shut down, because it costs money to shut down.
Do you think that, like, why wouldn't they just ride it out until the next government comes up and hopefully funding would go back up?
Yeah, it's
or is that like is it a done deal now? It's like the funding's gone. And it's really hard, a lot harder to get it back.
It's harder to get it back, and the chances of Fuse getting that many more. They did surveys, they did audience surveys. Who's our audience? It's mainly people in the arts who don't have large incomes, and they have a finite audience, basically. Even though it's a very, very fascinating and important magazine. There really wasn't much chance for them to develop their readership that much.
How couldn't they get 500 subscribers around the world? It's like online, right?
Oh, it's everywhere. Yeah, it's everywhere.
And they couldn't get 500.
I don't know the exact scenario.
I don't want to. I'm not saying.
But it was. There was more things that I probably shouldn't talk about on the radio.
Okay. All right. Well. Okay, well, that's a sad story.
But the positive side is, there's a positive side to all these things. They're going into like a final year, fundraising year. There's going to be a big campaign. They've made a movie. There's going to be some final issues. And their archive, preserving their archive, is where all the energy is going. So their archive will be searchable online with all the articles that have been written over 38 years. So it's not totally bad. I think it's actually good.
So in a way, the cuts are good.
I wouldn't say that, because I'd rather have like a sustainable, interesting magazine to read.
Right. But I guess it's maybe the it's nature of the art community that they'll deal with downtimes in creative ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's what would hopefully will happen and is happening. But there's other examples like that I think are important to talk about. And it's like arts organizations have to be prepared to kind of shift with where the government policy shifts. So like right now, there's a push. So there might be reductions in some places, but there's pushes for funding in other places, like to push the funding away from the downtown core of Toronto and into the Radiant City. And to further engage like newer communities, not established communities. And that's where the funding is being pushed right now.
By the federal government?
But actually, that's provincial. So, but that's really great, because then you get new organizations coming up and working and functioning. And then they become part of the establishment. So that is a really positive outcome of sort of shifting priorities. Another thing that happens to art organizations is that the three levels of government all have different priorities. So they need to sort of tailor themselves and tailor their activities to things that they think they can successfully apply for money from. So that it's often like quite a delicate dance to tailor your programming and tailor your activities so that you can maximize the funding that you can get. And it's difficult, right? Because you don't want to constantly change. You want to stand for a brand or something. But that's definitely one of the kind of strategic things you have to think about.
So strategically, the federal government and their cuts, are there areas where they actually haven't been cutting or they've been increasing that they do have an interest in terms of arts and culture?
No, actually, no, they haven't. Basically, I think it was in the news not that long ago, the Department of Foreign Affairs completely shifted their goal. So they used to sort of develop culture and develop Canada and promote Canada globally. They have cut that totally. They've told all their diplomats to say the only thing important talking about to do with Canada on a global stage is commerce and exports. And that's it. That's it. You can't say, you can't go to Venice and participate in the Venice Biennale and say, we're going to fund this gala. They won't do it. They
so
refuse.
We're exiting the international dialogue about arts, not just cutting arts internally.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Took a big step out globally. It's a shame. It's an embarrassment. Because you go to Venice, and then the Haitian pavilion will be the best party.
Right.
And the Canadian will be the saddest party, because you have to pay to get in. It's pathetic.
What are the further impacts of such cuts? And this sort of goes back to the Bubbles Galore issue.
Right.
When we recall the lots of the cuts to the NEA in the United States surrounded the Mapplethorpe photos.
Yes, and Andre Serrano.
Yeah. And here, similarly, there was the Sun TV coverage of the Modern Dance that sort of accused it of just being flailing and that the
photo
was worthless.
Right.
And so one of the effects of culture cuts seems to be not just that there's sort of less arts organizations that can function, but the ones that can function are the ones that have broader appeal. So that they can hit targets for subscribers or targets for viewers. And so maybe you can tell us a little about the effect of sort of self-censorship that arises in the context of such cuts.
Well, so the NEA, when we talk about the United States, they have a completely different model than us. So they have, and they also have like different established powers in their society that have to be pleased. So when you have like somebody controversial like Mapplethorpe or Andre Serrano being funded by the government, they're going to be upsetting certain groups. Now, the difference between that and Canada is that our funding bodies operate at an arm's length. So that means they report to the government, but the government is not involved in the jurying process. It takes a lot of work to actually facilitate the jurying process. There's tons of rules around it. You cannot serve on a jury more than once every 4 years, and they have to be from all regions of Canada. So it's incredibly logistically complicated to provide this sort of platform where individual works, which may or may not be controversial, are juried. And you don't know who's on the jury, and that jury will change. And so it's a completely separate endeavor from what the government would be involved in. Now, that's not explained very well in the media. So when you get something controversial like the woman from Modern Dance or Bubbles Galore, they kind of focus on this controversial element of the artwork and use it as a kind of argument for why should the so-called taxpayer fund their money to fund something as ostentatious as this work of art. But they skip over in the media the jurying process, which is as transparent and as fair and equal as could possibly be orchestrated. And Canada has the luxury of being a young country, seeing what other countries have done, and tailoring their model to an appropriate model. So they looked at the French model in France, and they looked at the British model, and they tailored their own jurying process, an arm's length process. So that's something that we have that has not been dismantled, that still goes on, that is very successful, that we want to maintain. And every so often, something controversial and will hit the news that sort of lights the fires of the powers that be or people that don't have access to the information to understand that it's a very fair and random process.
So the jurying structure that we have, which hopefully isn't under any threat.
Well, no, I mean, it's not under threat in a way that they're not going to say, now one person's going to decide everything.
Right. So thank God, thank goodness.
Yeah.
So that relieves any pressure on artists to focus on specific things based on where the funding is, other than I guess their themes.
Yeah, absolutely. Artists can keep applying. They can apply year by year with the same. I mean, if they're successful, they can't apply with the same project. They can keep applying. The juries will change. Different people will be evaluating it. And so it's a really, really great model and very fair. And you can... some agencies do provide feedback. Some agencies don't. So it just depends, you know, on what their own individual rules are.
Are the jurors paid? Is this an expensive or just complicated?
I don't think it's an expense. I think it's something like... Well, the County Council... will, I believe, fund the transport of people to come to Ottawa to jury these things. because it is a large country, and we do need input from people like Kamloops and Nunavut, and you know, I do believe that the Canada Council pays for that, but it's like a set number of days, like once a year, different people, constantly changing.
So what are some of the other expected impacts of some of the cuts that we've seen from the federal government?
Well, there is one that I can think of that's happening in Nova Scotia right now. It's kind of a municipal issue. It's not federal. But there's an established artist-run center there called the Khyber. And they had a wonderful building. And the building needed some restoration. I don't know if it was for asbestos or lead or something. But basically, it would cost the Khyber, which is non-profit, $45 million to retrofit their building to get rid of the asbestos and the lead. And they asked them for the money from the city of Halifax. And it was sort of placed in like a holding pattern. And because of the timeline of municipal politics, 5 years later, they might not want to shift the Khyber back into the building, which is called the Khyber as well. So it's kind of in a holding pattern. They've left the building. The Khyber has left the building, but they don't know if they're going to go back. So there's all kinds of scenarios, but there's positive ones too.
Intriguing.
And that comes from like private and public partnerships. So those are sort of something that the government does want to push. And there have been some quite positive developments there.
So let's talk about that.
Sure. Should we play another song first and then come back and talk about that?
No. Let's wait a little bit because we still have a little bit of time.
Okay, so like for example, I'll just give you one, like an example in Toronto. This doesn't have anything to do with the government. It has to do with philanthropists. And I'm sure everybody knows the Gladstone Hotel and what a success that has been. And then there's integration between arts and commerce there on a successful level. But the family that owns the Gladstone, the Zeidlers, also own 401 Richmond, which is another really excellent building. And what they've done is they have a sort of tiered rental system within the building. So if you're a for-profit retail store art gallery, you pay a certain amount in rent. If you're a nonprofit or an artist-run center or some nonprofit entity, your rent is rated accordingly. And so that kind of fosters this really interesting art world ecology there. And it goes totally under the radar, but it's been there for 30 plus years.
It sounds like it's run by artistically minded.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like corporations.
Yeah, architects. So they're family of architects. Yeah.
So what about, and now I'm thinking back to, I don't want to bring up Fuse again, but what if they had gone to, say, Honda or maybe GM and said, look, could you just buy 250 subscriptions from us?
You know, the thing with Fuse, their byline is art, politics, and culture. So they're a very leftist publication, very radical publication. And it would have gone against their mandate to partner with an entity such as GM or Honda.
So what are some of the not-so-leftist arts organizations that, or not don't name, you don't necessarily need to name arts organizations, but
yeah.
Like what is the... What are the negative impacts of partnering with a corporation who wants to fund the arts?
Well, I mean, the difficulty is that it's going to be, from now going forward, a case-by-case basis. So there won't be like a government structure with which these people partner. There will just be a free-for-all, which isn't bad because there's competent people everywhere. I'm just saying that it's now going to be case-by-case. So if you are X nonprofit and you want to partner with X private company, the two may have a structure, develop a structure one side or the other to, you know, either solicit partnerships or to solicit partnerships on both ways. There is no structure, so it's just going to be case by case. Like, it's not a bad thing. The thing with Fuse is they were caught in the middle with having such a strong mandate, which, I mean, you could argue that, so then you're sort of lessening these strong mandates, because if you have a very strong mandate, nobody's going to come and partner with you. So that's kind of like another argument there. But I don't think there's really a bad scenario. I mean, there's competent people everywhere. You can develop effective partnerships. It's just sadly unfortunate that the government doesn't see a role or a benefit in fostering these things.
Like, ideally, you'd want a lot of government funding and a lot of corporations that want to fund the art. Basically, you want everyone to...
Yeah,
you want everybody to buy into the arts.
Yeah, and there is a lot of tax incentives for large companies to partner. So that is there. That's something that they removed in the United States. They took away all the tax incentives for companies to partner, which is devastating. Here, that hasn't happened yet. So there are incentives for these companies to partner. They get a benefit as much as the organizations get a benefit. And there have been. I mean, think of Scotiabank, Nuit Blanche. That has been relatively a huge success in this city. So,
go ahead, Jim.
I was just going to ask about the... it's clear that we haven't gone down quite the road the U.S. has gone yet. Today, in fact, the Republicans are about... floated cutting funding for the NEA entirely.
They don't fund individual artists at all because of Serrano and Mapplethorpe.
Whereas the public private partnerships, so the Fuse example is an example of the impossibility of a particular collective being able to engage with that money, but which formerly had funding to at least have that voice heard.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was watching recently some CBC archive footage of they used to have a weekly show on current trends in poetry, which is sort of like, you know, the late 60s. It was accepted as being sort of a standard thing that the public broadcaster was required to do, was to keep up trends in culture, whereas now the CBC has more or less to compete with content derived from U.S. markets,
yeah.
Little of which has any contact with actual culture, and most of it is simply product placement or something else.
Yeah.
And so while there are opportunities arising in public-private partnerships for picking up the slack from some of the losses of government funding, at the same time, it does seem there's a general trend to kinds of art that a corporation could get behind, which may have a feedback loop to who could later get government funding based on CV and and practice, really, from having access to gallery space. I'm wondering about the modes of working for other kinds of funding models, or modes of struggling to re-achieve some of the old funding models that may be underway, or if, in a sense, we've already lost that route.
Okay, there's some artists that totally embrace the corporate partnership. They don't see it as a, like, they're not betraying their own artistic values or endeavors by partnering. They want it. So there's other artists that are, like, more conceptual, that don't even see a product as the final product, that maybe their product is very ephemeral. It only lasts for a few moments and then it's gone. Like, you have to kind of like have a very broad approach to what is considered art. So the private sponsorship model won't work for every single type of art production. It's just it's so hard to talk about this broadly. But I don't know what to say. It could be successful. It could be. I mean, okay, and I'll give you the example, and the example was the War of 1812, which the government did have a lot of funding. Their stand-in for funding for the arts was to fund this commemoration of the War of 1812.
Which just had its 100th...
Yeah,
1812.
Yeah.
So 100 and...
200.
So they focused all their funding and said, we're taking away ATS, don't worry, we're cutting the Canada Council of the Arts, don't worry, we're just going to fund this commemoration. So, like, on one side, it was... distressing, because this notion of promoting military might and the monarchy in place of the arts is very disturbing and worth asking questions about. I personally don't know why that's important. I'm not a warrior type person, so I don't know what the ultimate end is to glorify war is, or military endeavors. But that being said, they funded this thing at for the commemoration of the War of 1812 at Fort York, which allowed all these artists to sort of have a tent, so an old-fashioned tent, and furnish that tent or do an intervention in that tent however they wanted. And so there was hundreds of these tents. And so you could go to these tents, which looked very much in place at Fort York, and like go inside a little tent and see this artist's intervention. So it was super cool. And so you get this thing where, yes, it was the Harper government giving money towards this thing. Yes, it supposedly was commemorating war, military might, and the monarchy. But then these artists came in and were invited and applied and had ideas, and they got to execute their projects in that context, and it ended up being really interesting and really diverse. So it's not all bad.
Okay. we got to do another song.
Okay.
Excuse me. So let me just recap what's happening here. We're at Smash, which is in West Toronto, West End of Toronto, on Dundas Street. It's a fantastic store, which we call it's a showroom in the city's West End, 4,300 square feet. It's a well-regarded and inspiring source of high-quality vintage materials, furnishings, and fixtures. Alder's been very helpful in hosting us. We're here with Carmen Victor, and we're talking about austerity in the arts. And there's lots of movie taping going on outside the door. There's a film, some sort of film, a scary film. So, Carmen, given that context, what's the next song we're gonna listen to?
The next song is Franken Cottage by Dark Mean.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's really cute.
Okay.
Heard your name and I called it and I said it. Time we change our hearts more often. Silently
Okay, welcome back to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. You can find us at afterthecollapse.net. And you just heard Franken Cottage by Dark Mean.
Yes, by Dark Mean.
I got that right. Yeah. I got that the right way. And then, and also I'm Lewis Maroney, and this is Jim Vernon.
Hello.
Co-hosting this show called After the Collapse, exploring the link between economic exploitation and social injustice. We're talking about arts, austerity in the arts today with Carmen Victor. Welcome back, Carmen.
Thanks, Lewis.
And we are now into part three of our discussion about austerity in the arts. And Carmen, we've talked about the cuts that have been happening to the arts. We've talked about the impact of these cuts have to the arts. So what are some of the things that are happening within the arts community to combat or deal with these cuts?
It's difficult, but you know what? There's always amazing things happening, no matter really what climate politically is we find ourselves in. So there'll always be interesting interventions or works of art or artist projects or collectives or institutions that pop up. And that just, I'm just saying that it's not just Canada, because actually we have it very, we have it really good compared to other parts of the world. So despite all the sort of pessimism and the negative attention that often the arts gets, especially under the umbrella of this very neoliberal sorts of governments, even in, you know, our municipal scenario here, good things come out, which you would never imagine. And do you want me to give you an example?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's true. No, it's unbelievable, but it is true. So right now, under the Rob Ford regime, or is it, I don't know, I don't even know what to call it, clusterfuck comes to mind. But right now, we just passed added funding for the arts. We don't, it's not great. Like, it's not, it could be better. Like, comparatively to Montreal and, like, other cities of our same size, we don't give anywhere close to as much. But there's been a lot of work done by a lot of people over a long period of time that has finally culminated, and now there being more funding allocated to the arts, and that's through the billboard tax.
Oh.
Yeah, and it took a long time and a lot of discussion and many putting it off, but it's finally happening, and it was passed under Rob Ford. In fact, he agreed to it.
So the idea being that there's a tax added on to billboards that goes directly to the arts in Toronto.
I think it's 1%.
Yeah. And how does that get doled out?
Well, I mean, good question. It was agreed upon in theory. Now, if a big company wants to put up a billboard, there's a tax added onto there, which goes to the city, which the city then gives, you know, it filters through their various channels, and then they give it to the part of it to the Toronto Arts Council, which then, you know, returns it to the artists and funds various art projects. And so that means there's going to be an increase for artists in Toronto through the Toronto Arts Council.
That's a great approach. It reminds me of, I think it's Chapter 55, where for any, for example, condo developments that get built in a neighborhood, they need to give the city a certain amount of money or create a certain amount of green space.
Yeah. Check. I think it's a Section 33 or something. It's got...
Maybe sorry, double digit something.
Yeah. So no, that exists. And that's like a really great way. It's a really incentivized sort of way. And I think that is probably a really... I mean, it works. It's going to work for Toronto, and it's going to work, I think, hopefully in other areas beyond the arts.
Are there other similar projects, taxes, or things that the arts community is trying to push for, and who leads this charge?
Well, that one came from the grassroots. A really great guy called Devin Ostrom started this idea years ago, approached a city councillor with the idea, and then it just sort of slowly but assuredly developed. And now it's ensconced in city whatever, city council. But it's in delay right now, but that's okay. It's delayed at the moment, but they just put it off for a couple of years. But it is going to happen.
Right.
And it's happening, and it's really positive.
Great. So it's some of the energy of the arts community, rather than actually creating art, needs to think artistically in terms of
advocacy
and creatively in terms of how to get the funding that they need. And why can't artists just make art with no money and starve?
Yeah, I know. Everyone gets mad at artists. They're like, well, you're an artist. You should be a street person, too. basically, you know, it's this weird thing. It goes down to, like, the core values of what we value in society. People decided that they do not want to fund arts, that art is a frill. And I've been, like, combating that my entire professional life. Okay? It's not a frill. It's something that adds to us. We're a very developed nation. We should own our culture. We shouldn't see it as something that's negative, because there's countries that will fight for this,
right,
to be able to express themselves. And we just sit down and go, it's not important. But it is very important, despite what some people say. It's sometimes you just have to show people what culture is. And
right.
Then they go, wait, I couldn't live without my Game of Thrones.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say there's not a risk of art being snuffed out by lack of funding. Art will always exist. But what you're saying is, in a country like ours where we have the benefit of wealth,
mm-hmm.
we should invest the money in it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not.
It's there.
It's not a decadence. It's something that becomes part of your identity as a nation. It's not, and you know what? It's a very big nation, so it's very nuanced, and it's very varied, and it's very diverse. And so all of those things arise in the art that's produced, not just visual art, but all the arts. And so we have to sort of develop our audiences to understand that and to appreciate it. And really they do. You know, really they do. There's just a lot of things in between, and that is, you know, often media campaigns and, you know, the grab for headlines and wanting to seem controversial and wanting to create these hot spots where people get outraged. I mean, I think people love to get outraged.
This is actually one interesting sidebar to the whole discussion is within the last 15, 20 years, the general media tide against what you could loosely call the humanities. About once a year you get a list in the Globe and Mail of theses that are meant to be ridiculous written at universities with your funding, alongside lists of art exhibits that would offend general taste, which is a far cry from, say, the reconstruction of the 1940s, where the WPA and various organizations are sort of putting, you know, if you had a town of 300, you might have an opera company because money was around create jobs via education and culture.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's a certain extent in which the effect of austerity on the arts is a small microcosm of the effects of austerity in general, which tend to make us more atomistic, less interested, and more exhausted. I was actually thinking one thing we haven't talked about is the effect of gentrification on art, that at the same time that there's a series of cutbacks in funding, there's a series of increase in cost due to rent and food and other things going up in the areas of the city that might usually attract and house artists.
Mm-hmm.
This is another difference from Quebec, that is, we don't have rent control.
That's right.
What's it like living as a working artist and curator under these conditions?
It's awesome. So great. I've been very lucky in my career. I've worked in the post-secondary sector for 9 or 11 years, a long time. And within that scenario, there's an abundance of very motivated, invigorated, and dedicated people, all of whom value what we're talking about here in various ways. And they're not all contemporary artists, but some of them are interested in regional museums, and some of them are interested in military, you know, preserving the military history, and some people are interested in First Nations sort of promotion and history. So it's incredibly diverse. This tide against the humanities, it's very depressing to hear, but I think the private sector will get behind me 100% when I say that it's incredibly important to be able to express yourself in writing and orally, no matter what you're doing, and to be able to have critical thinking skills, which you all develop when you study the humanities. So, you know, come on, private sector, agree with me. Innovation, it's such a buzzword. Where do you think that comes from?
So at the end of the day, with the cuts to funding for the arts from the government, do you think that energy is better spent by the artistic community trying to get that funding back, or finding the money in the private sector, or just making do? What's the, or is it just a combination of them all? Are there areas of the artistic community that is actually better? Well, I guess we kind of talked about that with Fuse, coming back to that. I mean, Fuse was better run as a government funded, and then there's other artists that are just better as a privately funded. So
well,
it's a balance.
You can't judge, but the thing is that right now the feeling is that you're just trying to survive. You're just trying to get through, because there's this like hope and optimism that at some point there will be a new government elected, which will sort of think more progressively, not just about the arts, but about everything. Because there's no
transit. What are the Liberals and the NDP actually saying to the art community right now in terms of vote for us and we'll get
your
money
back?
I
basically think that even for them, well, I know for sure that the NDP want to develop national strategies. So they want to have a national strategy for transit, and hopefully there is a national strategy for arts. I mean, it may be very nebulous, but they believe in developing these national strategies. So, which we don't have like a national transit strategy right now, and there should be one. I mean, there should be, and don't even get me started on like climate change. All right, so this is something that's going to cataclysmically affect all of us. But, you know, it's like way down at the bottom. It's non-existent on the Harper government. So they just want to develop the tar sands. So there's things that... So the arts plays into it. The arts is an economic driver. I have my numbers here. So the arts contribute $84.6 billion to our economy. 7.4% of the GDP. And there's 1.1 million jobs in the arts. So, like, that is huge. That's a big player in the government, you know, pie chart. So to dismiss it on an ideological sense is just absurd, you know, even from an economic standpoint. So, but the other thing that is interesting is that a lot of, like, so, like, for example, the Canada Council, they recently put out the strategic plan, a new strategic plan, and the strategic plan doesn't operate on the sense of the economy growing and growing and growing, which has been, you know, a constant since the end of World War II. It's always this, since the end of World War II, grow the economy, you'll succeed. So we've kind of come to the end of that now. Growing the economy has grown so much that our world can't sustain it anymore. We're just spewing pollution, and, you know, there's real major issues that haven't been addressed globally or nationally or whatever. So the arts fits in there as an economic driver in any case. There are many institutions, many venues for it, you know, in the places like the ROM and the AGO, down at artist-run centers, down to individual artists making work and having exhibitions. So it's just such a variety, it's such a huge culture, it's such a huge, like, art ecology that we have to sustain it and value it and be aware of it. And not denigrate it.
Is there a risk that in lack of funding or this anti-art mentality, at least on the government side, is there a risk we would miss like the next Leonardo da Vinci, or that one of these potentially great artists, like, oh, what if Einstein never... You know, what if he died of starvation when he was young? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. It should be Canadian. We should say Jack Bush.
Canadian.
Yeah, I don't know any Canadian.
It's possible, but it's more... But no, because you know what? There's all kinds of curators that are constantly in touch with the community and looking for just that. And when they find it, they promote it. And those people are, you know, divorced from the government machinations on the most part.
So it's the mediocre artists that are... that we're really talking about.
I know,
about
like, what, you're only supposed to have these, like, overachieving artists, and then you can't have... No, but it's, like, the same thing. Like, craft fair versus the AGO is a whole spectrum, everything in between, and we should, as a nation, be able to nurture that.
So if we have time, yeah. we've been talking to Carmen Victor over in Smash at the West End amidst all of these really cool pieces of furniture and art. We've been talking about austerity in the arts, and I'm going to suggest, Carmen, if we had time to do another song, we would do Gravity's Rainbow,
yes.
Because it's one of the shorter ones. Do you have anything to say about this song?
I just love the klaxon so much.
Great.
They're awesome.
It's a great novel. That was Gravity's Rainbow by Klaxons. We're here at Smash talking to Carmen Victor. You're listening after the collapse on RadioRegion.com. And so just to close, Carmen, why don't you tell us a few things about the work you're doing at YYZ?
So YYZ is one of Toronto's most established artist-run centres. I'm lucky to be on the board of directors there. Not in crisis mode, which is really great, but still feeling these effects of what we've been talking about here. One of the examples that I believe is a really positive example is the way that, because of some of the funding directions that we've had, YYZ has now expanded its programming in order to sort of develop its own programming, maintain its own mandate to support contemporary artists, but also in line with what the funding agencies want, which is to develop this Radiant City part of Toronto. So YYZ has opened up this opportunity for submissions to conduct a program at YYZ. So, but they have to be located in, like, they have to come from the Radiant part of Toronto. And so they'll have July and August. Whoever is selected will have July and August to execute this whatever their proposal is. I don't know what they are because the call just went out. So, it's going to be really exciting because then you get, you know, some new developing under exposed artist group or collective or artist gets the chance to kind of have their project come to fruition at YYZ, which is established, has a space, can really help mentor and provide people with a new platform. So that is in direct response to what our funders want us to do. And it's good. It's going to be exciting.
A light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
Okay, well, excuse me. Carmen, thank you so much for sitting and talking with us.
Thanks, you guys.
So this was Carmen Victor. We've been talking to her about austerity in the arts and on After the Collapse, which you can learn more about at afterthecollapse.net. We air on radioregent.com, and we've been recording this at Smash, which is at 2880 Dundas Street West in Toronto. So thank you to them. You can find their website at smash.to. Thanks to them. Thanks to Alder. Thanks, Carmen. Jim, you want to say thanks?
Thank you, everyone.
Okay, great.